All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Good to see you. I'll start with the good news. This is the last of the lectures on NATO's new security challenges, so you won't have to listen to any more of these after today. And then I'll give you the bad news. You'll have to find somewhere else to go for your lunch on a rainy Thursday in Brussels. Those of you who have followed the lectures over the last few months will know that, of course, this has not been designed as a series that is covering every conceivable security challenge. I haven't spoken about pandemics. I haven't spoken about the population boom, nor about issues such as water scarcity or even migration flows. Indeed, there are a lot of security challenges out there, but I have tried to zoom in on those six challenges which are most likely to be on NATO's agenda in the next few years, and which, of course, are the challenges that Madeleine Albright and her group of experts are taking up within the context of NATO's new strategic concept. So you recall, we started looking at proliferation, we've looked at terrorism, we've looked at energy security, we've looked at climate change, last time at failed and failing states, and today the last major issue, of course, cyber. Now, I mention this because at the back of my mind, and probably at the back of your minds, as we've had the series, is the question, well, are these six challenges of equal priority for NATO? Should NATO be devoting its resources equally by cutting them into six different portions to these six challenges? Are some more dangerous than others? This is the question which I'm going to try to answer at the end of my lecture today. Are there one or two of the challenges that I've described which should perhaps, because of their imminence or the potential destructiveness, have a higher priority ranking than others? So that's I'll leave you in suspense, if I can, for the next 40 minutes or so before I get to that question. But I think it's one that has to be answered if this series is to be, at least from an intellectual point of view, successfully concluded. But before we get there, let's look at cyber. An issue, as you know, which is now increasingly in the newspapers and increasingly the focus of all kinds of think tank and government reports and studies. Now, it's obvious that the most dramatic development in human existence over the last 20 years has been the incredible growth in information technology. I'm one of the very few in this room who actually lived through and remembers the pre-internet age, which I imagine for somebody of my children's generation is like having lived through the Stone Age. The time when you had to, if you wanted information on an American university course, you had to write a letter, enclose a stamped addressed envelope, and wait for 1 month, if you were lucky, for something to come back in the post. Now you download the information, of course, and the application forms in a fraction of a moment. Today, virtually the whole of human existence, whether private or professional, is moving into cyber space. Most of our lives will increasingly be spent in that virtual world. We communicate online. We do our banking online. We pay our taxes online. We go shopping online. We express our political opinions online. We even get married online, or at least we find our partners that way. When in my generation, if you wanted to find a marriage partner, you had to go to the Club Mediterranee and spend a lot of money getting yourself to a distant Mediterranean beach in the hope that you would be successful. No more do you need to do that. Now, of course, we all know that one of the great challenges of the 21st century is, will we be able to transfer to the virtual world, the world of cyberspace, where more and more of our activity will be happening, the same rules, the same regulations, the same behavioural understandings that we have tried to achieve in the physical world? My wife works for the music industry, and the difficulty of transferring issues such as copyright, for example, into the virtual world has been devastating in terms of the volume of sales of CDs and the revenue of the music industry, which has fallen by virtually two-thirds. In fact, it's also not just a question of new standards, but of developing entirely new business models. models. And of course, the big question, particularly when you look at cyber, is will the next 20 years see the same phenomenal growth of the internet as the last 20 years, and therefore as the use of internet expands to ever more parts of the globe, will the cyber protection, cyber vulnerability issues also expand at the same exponential pace? I'll try to answer that question today. But already, since the middle of last year, we are in a situation where the number of personal computers in the world has passed the 1 billion mark. We are now in a situation where more than half of humanity has a mobile phone, 3.5 billion are now currently in circulation. And therefore, of course, the number of vulnerabilities, the number of potential attack routes has grown in line with the expansion of the number of systems. Now, this can sometimes have amusing overtones. Many of you remember when the Spanish EU presidency kicked off a few weeks ago, we had on the Spanish official website not the picture of Prime Minister Zapatero, but the picture of Mr. Bean, at least for a couple of days. In my country, there was some amusement that the wife of the incoming head of the British Intelligence Service, John Sawyers, put on her Facebook site all of the details of his movements, of where they went on holiday, the dinner parties with their friends. Now, that was, I must say, not an actual cyber attack. That was basically negligence, bad personal security on the web. And I'll have a few words to say about that in a moment, because obviously not all compromise of information is the result of a deliberate attack. Indeed, negligence and bad security is still responsible for the massive proportion, even today, of illicit information transfers and compromises. But more and more, what we are seeing is that hackers are not doing this for their own personal reputation or glory, but deliberately for profit. And companies are being increasingly the victim of cyber attacks. A recent poll in Germany found that 40% of all of the German companies consulted had experienced significant cyber penetration and loss of information, commercial secrets, over the last year. And of course, we've had in the last couple of days this massive attack against Google launched from China, which not only involved Google but 24 other companies. And of course, it's not only the commercial compromises that result from that, but also the fact that emails are then accessed, which give access to other people's personal information. And indeed, a number of human rights campaigners using Google have potentially been compromised as well. So we see cyber not only as something which is used for commercial gain, but could also be an instrument of state repression in many respects, as if it's used to spy on one's own population by gaining access to their private emails. We've also seen how, too, the increasing use of cyber attacks to promote political information campaigns. Those of you who remember the Copenhagen Climate Conference last year will remember that just about a week beforehand, 2 weeks beforehand, somebody hacked into the database of the University of East Anglia, the Centre for Climate Change, which is one of the most prominent ones in the United Kingdom, downloaded a whole mass of emails, which were then exploited to show that even climate change scientists have doubts about the seriousness of climate change or the speed of climate change. And this was, of course, a grist to the mill of the anti-climate change campaigners just in a run-up to Copenhagen. And finally, and of course this is particularly coming from NATO, going to be one of my themes today, we also see the increasing vulnerability of cyber space when it comes to defence operations. One of the more spectacular things just before Christmas was that by capturing fortuitously a computer belonging to an Iraqi insurgent group, the Pentagon learned that, in fact, those insurgent groups were able to hack into the American Predator drone systems operating and actually download the video that was being filmed by the drone. And all of this apparently was made possible because of a sky grabber system, which is available on the internet for as little as $25. So cyber is different from the normal type of attack. Normally you know that you're being attacked and pretty soon afterwards, but it could be weeks, months, years sometimes after an attack is initiated before you actually know that you have been, your systems have been compromised and you're being attacked. Here we must also, ladies and gentlemen, keep a distinction which is not always made. You obviously know that you're being attacked if you're systems are paralysed, if they cannot function any longer. And we obviously think of Estonia, I'll come back to that in a moment, in 2008, and other states or companies that have been subject to those paralysing attacks. But 90% of cyber attacks are to basically download information, confidential information, to drain information out, which means that you can perfectly use your computer and all of the other systems while this is taking place, so you don't actually know that you have been compromised. Like in the case of the Pentagon and the drones over Iraq, often it takes a lucky discovery before you know that something has happened. So the question I think we have today is, are cyber attacks going from a kind of inconvenience to a WMD? And a WMD can have two meanings, either a weapon of mass disruption or a weapon of mass destruction. There is, of course, a difference of proportion between the two. Well, at first sight, yes, the problem is increasing. Cyber is the ultimate in asymmetrical warfare. First of all, anybody can do it. You don't have to be a state spending billions of dollars on technical capabilities, which is certainly the case for nuclear weapons or chemical or biological weapons or air forces or armies. No, you only have to be an individual with basic training and a computer. So there is a tremendous disproportionality, the damage that one computer can do to potentially millions of computers in an adversary's system. No other weapon ever known in history has that inverse proportionality. As nobody gets killed, at least until now, according to my research, nobody has yet died of a cyber attack. The sense of outrage or the need to retaliate is obviously less than what would happen 9/11 terrorism, where people are directly killed. You can very effectively cover your tracks. It often takes months of very punctilious investigation for a whole range of countries and jurisdictions before you can be certain that you know where that attack came from. By the time you're able to finish those investigations, the attacker has dismantled the system, has changed his or her web address or whatever, and has moved on as well. As one analyst put it at a conference I was at the other day, the cyber is, if you like, the conflict between the strong and the complacent in Western societies and the weak but motivated. In other words, the ultimate asymmetric weapon. The other thing, of course, which I think is interesting about cyber, and this point was made by the chief of the British Defence Staff recently, Sir Jock Stirrup, is that cyber is unlike previous conflicts. Previous conflicts are normally war and peace. Although we did, of course, have the Cold War, which was a state of enduring tension. But you know, the weapons are used and then the weapons fall silent. Yes, until those weapons are used again. So we have distinct phases between war and peace. But cyber, as Sir Jock Stirrup put it, means that the switch is always on. In other words, whatever the state of international relations, in terms of physical, the potentiality for physical conflict, cyber probes, cyber testing, cyber attacks never end. It's even calculated by some analysts that countries such as China have assembled within the People's Liberation Army up to 100,000 operators who work full-time, as a full-time 9-to-5 job in probing the systems of other countries. And it's also calculated at the moment that about 100 countries in the world, 100 countries, which is the majority, are actively developing offensive, not defensive, but offensive cyber capabilities. The company that helped me with my research for today's lecture, Symantec, American-based company, which publishes a very useful, by the way, annual report on cyber vulnerabilities, mainly in the private sector, but still very good. This company calculates that an attack takes place every quarter of a second. 1.5 billion attacks take place every day. And as I said, unlike previous weapons, these attacks can be organised from anywhere in the world against anywhere in the world. Of course, one of the reasons for this is that there are more potential viruses, bots or whatever, that can be used. About 10 million computers are calculated to be, if you like, bot computers or contaminated computers involved in cyber attacks at any one time. Even in NATO, with our own systems, it's calculated that we face sometimes more than 100 different attacks, or at least attempts to get into our systems with every single week. That means, if you look at the statistics, a phenomenal exponential growth in viruses. Symantec calculates that in as little ago as 2002, there were 20,547 malicious codes. That number had gone up to 113,025. These figures seem to be incredibly precise, but those are the figures by 2005. By 2007, the number had gone up to 624,000. And last year, 1,656,000. I was told that by this year, 2010, about 3 million identified viruses will be in circulation. That means, and you know I love these statistics, that if your chance of being struck by lightning is 1 in 26 million, your chance of being involved in a car accident is 1 in 300. Your chance of getting a snake bite is 1 in 42 million, but your chance of being a subject to some kind of cyber infiltration attack is 1 in 5. So this is a truly universal problem. And of course, what worries an analyst as more, not only as more information is put onto the web. For example, if you looked at the Financial Times yesterday, there was a very interesting report. It was an interview with the US Deputy Secretary of Defense, William Lin, where it was reported that one attack apparently launched from within China, one single attack, managed to download more information illicitly than is contained in the US Library of Congress. Somewhat mind-boggling, yes? But as more of the basic critical infrastructure of our daily lives, it becomes digitalised, whether we're talking about power stations or transport networks, air traffic control systems, of course, hospital systems or whatever, then, of course, the ability of attacks not just to compromise information, but in fact to paralyse systems increases. Now, interestingly enough, according to Symantec, the majority of data breaches occurs in the field of education, 27%, government, 20%, and healthcare, 15%. But coming back to what I said earlier, interestingly, 57% of all of the breaches is due to theft or loss. About 2 years ago, the UK government had this unbelievably embarrassing story the details of all of the social security recipients in Britain, which were on one computer disk, had disappeared. That was, of course, a boon potentially for criminals, with details about bank accounts and so on. But it wasn't the result of a hack. It was the result of somebody mislaying the disk. Indeed, a recent poll of a number of companies in Western Europe revealed, and I'm not sure if any of you here today are also going to confess to this, but that 59% of employees admitted to taking company information home. One in 10 reported that in the last 2 years they had lost a laptop, a smartphone, or a USB flash drive as well. So bad policies, in other words, lax security, bad practice, still accounts for about, the majority almost, of cyber compromises. Now, that's the good news, ladies and gentlemen. But before we get to the more worrying news, that's the good news. In other words, it does suggest that if we tighten up our security arrangements, we can potentially eliminate, according to a NATO source that I consulted on this, up to 90% of potential compromises of information. Crime is still responsible for about 90% also of all cyber compromises. Some statistics, for example, a report by the former National Director of National Intelligence in the US, actually put the damage to the US economy up to $100 billion per year of the theft of confidential commercial information. Other reports that I've consulted put it far less, around $1 or $2 billion a year. I admit there's a big difference between that, but we know that nonetheless anything over $1 billion is still rather significant. One particular hack in the United States managed to steal the identities of 8.4 million Americans, 3% of the population. One credit card company, I won't give the name, calculates that one attack managed to steal the details of 94 million of its credit card users. And that credit card company also reported that every breach of confidential information cost the company $67 million to repair. What is that information for? It's basically criminal gangs who then sell it. Credit card info, identity info, bank account info, and so on. Unsurprisingly, because of its broadband and it's the number of connected digitalized citizens, the US is the top country for malicious activity, 23%. China 9%, growing fast as well, which means although China is often in the newspaper reports as a country where much of the cyber activity takes place, it's also a country which is increasingly the victim too of those cyber attacks. It's interesting though that many of the NATO countries are on the list. Germany 6% of the number of attacks, the UK 5%, Spain 4%, France 3%, and as the access to broadband increases, other countries are coming onto the list. Brazil, Poland, Russia, Turkey, India are the ones that I've covered recently. At the same time, this, of course, has led to a massive investment in cyber defense. The US Congress last year appropriated $7.3 billion. Massive amount, simply for the protection of government computer systems. And you have to add that to the billions of dollars that private American companies are now protecting. And the company, again, which was very helpful to me for my research, Symantec, also reports that they now have 240,000 sensors in over 200 countries of the world. And they are now monitoring over 130 million systems, gateway systems, in their database. So clearly, this is going to be, whether you're a criminal or whether you're defending yourself, an increasingly a financially strenuous area. Now, I mentioned that a lot of the answer lies in better security. So what should we be doing if 90% of the solution is in our hands? Well, the first thing is cyber attack is a bit of a misnomer. Attack sort of suggests that you have to sort of force your way in. Overcome resistance, as it were. But, of course, that's not the way it happens. Attacks happen because the software lets you in if you simply find the right approach. So, obviously, in terms of protecting, the first thing is that we have to expect to be probed. We have to consider that this is the norm rather than the exception, and we obviously have to sponsor research. Which is clearly going to find ways, first of all, of being able to detect attacks, and secondly, which is going to test the vulnerability of our systems. George Marshall, one of my great heroes, the founder of the Marshall Plan, he had a phrase at the end of every meeting. Marshall would always say, "Right, now tell me, what can go wrong?" That was his phrase all the time. And I think we need to answer that question as also, what can go wrong? We need to sponsor research in that area. We also have to create standards in computer network defence. I'm struck that many organisations run a number of different computer networks, and interestingly, some have much higher standards of protection than others. One thing which is classic, particularly in military systems, is that people tend to protect the networks which contain secrets. Right. But if you are in Afghanistan, what's the most important computer network? Logistics. But logistics doesn't contain secrets, so it's less protected. But it could be far more important to running a military operation than the network which is, in fact, protecting secrets. Government also has to promulgate standards, like it does for chemical industries or nuclear industries, safety standards, also for companies in the area of cyber. And I also believe that one of the things that the government is increasingly going to do is to form some kind of backup system where industry can relocate if the key industries are subject, like health or food or water, are subject to cyber attacks. For example, after the Georgian attack in 2008, which was the prelude to the conflict in Georgia, the Georgians were able to rehost their information systems on an American internet service provider. So we need an international form of cooperation whereby countries that are subject to attacks are able to, as I say, relocate elsewhere very quickly. Another area is cyber forensics. You may recall, ladies and gentlemen, that when we spoke about proliferation, right at the very beginning, we spoke about nuclear forensics. Can you actually sort of find out from a particular fissile substance where it came from? Does it carry a signature? And I think increasingly, cyber forensics, can we sort of find out from a particular style, a particular methodology, a particular sort of code that country X is behind this rather than country Y. We also need deception. Classic wars or any type of competition has an element of deception. My favourite story, which is well known, is the way in which the Americans and the British created a fictitious army, the American First Army, in Kent and Sussex in World War II under General Patton, with tents, with rubber tanks, with cardboard aircraft to fool the Germans that the attack, you remember D-Day, was going to come across the Pas-de-Calais into Boulogne. And Hitler believed it and therefore left Normandy, where the real attack occurred, comparatively defenceless. If the German troops in the Pas-de-Calais under General Rommel had been in Normandy on D-Day, God knows how World War II would have ended. And we need similar deception against cyber attackers. They are trying to deceive us, so we have to deceive them. There are things which I'm not technically enough to understand, but which are called honeypots or honey nets and so on, which you can use to sort of attract a cyber attacker and then learn about the techniques that he is using in order to see what he knows about you and therefore plug your vulnerabilities as well. We have to use far more safety measures like authentication codes so that you know that the information is coming from the person who says that person is providing the material. We need more encryption as well. It sounds very military, but in our private systems as well. Now, ladies and gentlemen, all of this debate, of course, has now prompted a very important question, which is to how can we defend ourselves against these type of activities? As you know, any military person or strategist will say, well, look, you know, there's defence, there's deterrence, and there's counterattack. These are the three essential principles of strategy. And you do have, of course, a whole group of people who believe that the cyber world is no different from other areas of military activity, which is to say that you can't rely upon defence alone. The William Lind, I quoted him, who was in the Financial Times yesterday, the American Deputy Secretary of Defense, was saying, we can't have a Maginot line here where you simply wait to be attacked. No, you've got to have some sort of maneuverable facility. And I've read whole papers, for example, from the American Academy of Sciences on the issue of cyber attack, in the sense of counterattack, the defender counterattacking and deterrence. My own feeling, after having looked at a lot of this, is that defence is still probably the best option that we possibly have, improving our defences. Why is this? Well, essentially, as you can imagine, because deterrence is difficult. Deterrence relies upon the other person having assets which are as valuable to him as your assets are to you. So in the Cold War, it was that if you destroy Moscow, I can destroy New York. That's equivalent, and therefore I hold that hostage. So we both lose equally. The problem, as I said, ladies and gentlemen, when it comes to cyber, is that the asymmetry doesn't make that happen. Your sort of a water system is much more important to you than the attacker's one single PC is to him. So how can you use deterrence if you can't hold something else hostage? Indeed, most analysts feel that you have to go outside cyber to deal with this issue. For example, if you know that country X is launching attacks on your system, you probably send the prime minister to go to that country, as Chancellor Merkel went to Beijing some months ago, and you raise the issue publicly, or you use diplomacy, or you use economic sanctions, or you take the issue to the UN because of unfriendly behaviour. But deterrence within cyber, where you're dealing with this asymmetry, is very difficult. You cannot disarm. You cannot have a disarmament treaty, as much as you would like to have one, as you have with nuclear weapons, to sort of, you know, get rid of the other person's assets when that person can buy the means to reconstitute a cyber attack so cheaply. There are bots, for example, which you can buy on the internet now for as little as 25 cents. The price is coming down all the time. The only good news, by the way, in cyber is that as the price of the bugs goes down, the actual price of firewalls goes down as well. So that is at least something that we can build on. Similarly, with retaliation, counter-attack, the problem here is, what if you get it wrong? Who's attacked you? Because you do it over hastily. One of the problems with cyber attacks is what the experts call false flags. It's very easy for somebody to disguise. So you're attacking me, but I think it's you, because you disguise under a false flag your identity. And therefore, I attack a third party who then gets involved in a cyber confrontation against me, because that person says, why me? Why have you attacked me? The other thing is, as a very brilliant RAND analyst called Martin Libitsky, who writes very interestingly on these issues, has said, digital clarity, I quote, digital clarity is a property of high-definition television, not cyber war. In other words, electrons don't always behave in the way that you want. For example, one problem is that you may, if you attack somebody else's system, not only sort of dismantle the thing that you're trying to attack, let's say a military system, but lots of civilian infrastructure at the same time. Nobody wants to counterattack against a military system and end up by putting, for example, hospital incubators out of action. What would be the consequences of international law of that sort of thing happening? There's also, of course, a big difference here, conceptually, in terms of an attack which causes inconvenience, such as espionage, which has been going on, we all know, since the beginning of time. The world's second oldest profession, as it was often called in the old days. And cyber is simply another form of human intelligence. So it's much cheaper to do it by cyber than have to recruit spies and send them to a country to gather information. So that cannot really be called a casus belli, something which would start an actual confrontation, particularly if nobody dies. So at what level does a cyber attack actually become a NATO Article 5 or a casus belli, at which you believe that you are dealing with the equivalent of an actual physical attack of the same standing? Robert Gates, the American Defense Secretary, has said, I quote, we need a declaratory policy about which level of cyber attack can be construed as an act of war. But so far, we lack that type of definition. In the same way, as I said in my terrorism lecture, that it's very difficult to know when a terrorist attack is of a magnitude which should instigate an Article 5 collective response or a military response as well. Another thing, of course, is that people sometimes don't like to admit they are being attacked. It's embarrassing. to admit that your system has been penetrated. If you're a bank, the last thing you want is to tell your customers that all of their credit card details have been stolen. There's a temptation to keep it quiet, to avoid embarrassment, while you try to improve your systems or deal with the issue quietly with the party that you feel has been attacking you. If you go public, then you get into all kinds of problems of posturing, of face-saving, you know, not being seen to lose face, public pressure, so on. The other thing about, by the way, a public instance is that other people may decide to attack on your behalf when you don't want them to. For example, you remember the Estonian, the famous Estonian cyber attacks of a few years ago, which for 3 days had a very damaging effect on the public administration systems of Estonia. A lot of that was, of course, the emotional reaction to the Estonian decision to remove a Soviet statue from the centre of Tallinn, you remember. And therefore, many of the people who instituted that attack may have been what we call patriotic hackers, people who say, I'm not waiting for the government to hit back, I'm going to do it on behalf of the government. NATO suffered in 1999 a major ping bombardment during the Kosovo air campaign. And again, this was very much people who were sympathetic to the Serb cause internationally, the diaspora, not waiting for Belgrade to do something, but saying, we are going to do it on behalf of the government, and therefore how can you control these people who may then precipitate a diplomatic crisis by thinking that they're doing what you want them to do and they're acting on your behalf. So, ladies and gentlemen, I think when we come to go beyond defence into deterrence or counterattack, not that governments won't develop capabilities or look at this, if only, again, to deter attacks, but they are fraught with all kinds of legal and technical and procedural complications, which still, to my mind, makes defence the best policy. But, of course, it's got to be an intelligent defence. A person I spoke to recently showed me 2 photos on this. He said, Jamie, here's the Great Wall of China, and here are the walls around Istanbul, Constantinople. And the wall of Great Wall of China was just one. Not the Chinese firewall, but the Great Wall, which means you only have to breach one defence and you're in. Istanbul was interesting. It was a series of walls, which means that, therefore, if the first line of defence doesn't succeed, others are behind. This strikes me as a good way to go. Now, at the end, strategic implications. From the point of view of a strategist, cyber is a worrying, yes, but a fascinating subject. The key issue, of course, is to what degree does this go beyond a societal threat, an inconvenience, a commercial problem, to become a threat to sort of our societies, which is what we associate classical war with. Here, strategists tend to divide into 2 camps. There are those like, for example, Bruce Berkowitz, well-known American commentator, in the face of war, who says, the main message is this. The information revolution has fundamentally changed the nature of combat. To win wars today, you must first win the information war. So in other words, war in cyberspace, and only in cyberspace, is a decisive sort of campaign in its own right. You know, you can actually win the war just in cyberspace without doing anything else. Other well-known strategists, like Colin Gray, University of Reading in the UK, is somewhat more sceptical and believes that cyber warfare can win battles, but not the actual war itself. My own sense, having sort of looked at this, is to be more on the side of Colin Gray than Bruce Berkowitz. There's no doubt, ladies and gentlemen, any of you who studied the history of warfare, that a technological advantage gets you a very long way. The whole history of the Second World War is that there was, on the one hand, a campaign fought on the battlefield, Stalingrad, Normandy, elsewhere. But there was, of course, another campaign, which you can argue was almost equally significant, which was being fought in the laboratory. The decisive breakthroughs there were when the British broke the German navigation beam technology, which was used in the German bombing campaign against the UK in 1940. Of course, then there was the great battle where the British broke the Ultra Code used by the German Enigma machine, so they could read the German cable traffic as well. Those, of course, gave the UK a significant advantage, or the Allies a significant advantage. But I don't believe, ladies and gentlemen, frankly, that anybody would argue that those breakthroughs alone were really what won the Second World War for the Allies. What won was ultimately having to go all the way to Berlin on both sides and bring about an end to the Hitlerian regime that way. So if you look at Clausewitz, who said famously that war consists of four elements: danger, exertion, uncertainty and chance. I would say that information superiority is something that certainly helps you to lessen the impact of those four elements, but you can't eliminate them altogether. One thing is to have superiority of information. Another thing is to know what to do with it. And I think World War II is a very good example where the country which was the most technologically advanced of all, Nazi Germany, in many respects, the best scientists, the best technology, the first to invent the rockets, the V1s, the V2s, etc., ultimately still failed to win. It's all about morale, discipline, training, leadership, public support, and of course having the right strategy at the end of the day. So I do not believe that cyber attacks are going to be any more the kind of miracle weapon that wins conflicts in itself, any more than, for example, air power was. In the 1920s and 30s, there was a tremendous fear in Europe that air power would be such a decisive weapon that once used, populations would give up immediately. As Stanley Baldwin, British Prime Minister, said, the bomber will always get through. When it happened on both sides, the German blitz against the UK, the US British bombardment of Germany from 1941 to the end, when it came, air power achieved far less than the proponents of it believed. It did not break the will of the population. It did not stop the German production of aircraft or ball bearings or whatever. Richard Overy, who is Britain's best historian of World War II, looked at this very closely and concluded that, yes, the Anglo-American air campaign against Germany did have a big impact on the Second World War, but not because it did what it was intended to do, break German infrastructure, break the will of the population, paralyse the German economy, but because it forced Germany to take so many assets out of the Russian campaign on the Eastern Front to devote to air defence against the bombers, that the Germans left themselves short. It was more asset transfer rather than destruction as such. I find that a convincing argument. So there's no, therefore, evidence to my mind that cyber will sort of revolutionise the basic nature of war any more than the nuclear weapon has done or any more than air power has done at the time. What happens is that we learn to live with these weapons, ultimately, and integrate them in our strategy. So therefore, what is the implication of cyber attacks in this respect? The first thing is that I believe it can give you a short-term advantage at the beginning. Rather like First World War, shelling the enemy, you remember, at the Western Front, softening up the enemy before you went over the top and moved the troops in. It was a prelude to combat. You try to sort of paralyse, remember shock and awe? During the Iraq War of 2003, you try to paralyse your adversary's communication systems so that there's less resistance when the troops go in. What we've found so far is the impact of cyber attacks is rather short-lived. For example, Estonia, there were, as you know, in 2007, 2004, 2005, 2006, a few years ago, recently, but the one that's had the most publicity, the attacks were very short-lived. They were short bursts of about an hour each time, very few longer, and after 3 days, the Estonians had patched their systems and were back up and running. So in other words, you suffer a temporary setback, but very quickly you reroute your systems, you put a patch on, and you're up again. So the impact of cyber is surprisingly short-lived, so it's best if it's done by surprise. But of course, to the extent that we expect to be attacked, and are constantly building defences against the probes, the element of a mass cyber surprise can be somewhat restricted. So therefore, that's where I see cyber as intervening. Secondly, I think that there are some principles that we need to look out for. The first one is that we have to build a disincentive to somebody to try to attack us first by making it more complicated, by quicker responses, and by being able to anticipate attack is happening. Secondly, and these are intellectual problems, we have to prevent a cyber attack from turning into a real war. The problem with, as you know, ladies and gentlemen, the strategy is that sometimes, you know, needling each other, remember the Arabs and the Israelis in the past, before 1967, before the Yom Kippur War of 1973, you know, needling each other, just testing each other, can get out of hand. There can be a miscalculation by one side, and suddenly, you know, instead of having a little sort of boxing game, you are in a real war. So how do you prevent this kind of constant cyber, you know, attacks from turning into a real confrontation? How can we de-escalate and not just escalate? Thirdly, how do we know when a cyber attack has been terminated? What guarantee do we have that the side has said, right, I'm giving up now, I've stopped, you know, we're going to sign a peace treaty and promise not to do it again, as opposed to just a pause before the whole thing starts up again? We have to work our way, to my mind, through those three key issues. And then finally, ladies and gentlemen, international law. What can we do to bring about a new sort of international regime which could make it, or which could produce a consensus that cyber attacks are criminal offences, which will be punished as such, not just, you know, boys in garages, teenagers in garages, having some fun to amuse themselves in the evening, and which could act as a deterrent, particularly, as I say, when you can't have computer disarmament. Well, I think, first of all, there can be a law vis-à-vis internet service providers, an international agreement, that they are responsible for the malware or the spyware or the adware or whatever that passes through their systems, that they have a responsibility for policing their systems. They're not just passive transmitters. Finland, for example, has a very effective legislation regarding anti-spoof activity on internet service providers. That's perhaps a model that can be looked at. Secondly, there has to be a standardisation of legislation that cyber attacks are treated equally wherever they occur. For example, Argentina is a case where, I'm not sure if this is the case today, but a few years ago, cybercrime as such was not recognised, and therefore hackers could go free. And you cannot, any more than you want, havens for terrorists in Yemen or in Afghanistan, you cannot want safe havens for hackers in areas where the legislation is far less strenuous. So, thirdly, you need international conventions with teeth. The problem at the moment is we have a Council of Europe convention on cybercrime, but where there is no implementation or enforcement mechanisms, these things are nice in a moral sense of condemning attacks, but don't have teeth. One problem is that Russia has had hesitations about this convention because it does not like the idea of international officials or the law enforcement agents of other countries being able to play a role in Russia itself. You know, all countries are very sensitive about the law officials of other countries having jurisdiction on their territory. Forgive me for my historical analogy, but when I did my research into the origins of the First World War at university, I was really struck. You know, in 1914, Serbia rejected an ultimatum from Austria-Hungary. You remember? But what you maybe don't remember is that the Serbs accepted every single point of the Austrian ultimatum, except one, and that caused the First World War, which was they would not allow Austrian judges to sit on their courts. That was it. That was the deal breaker which produced World War One. So that is a sensitive issue. But still, the international legal convention is something that has to be looked at far more. So, ladies and gentlemen, where are we? Well, I think on cyber, like everything else, pas de panique, no paranoia. Particularly, as I've said, that 90% of infiltrations can be stopped through better security procedures. That's the first thing. Secondly, this is not the equivalent of a classical weapon. If a major nuclear exchange took place in the world, we could go back to the Stone Age. If all of our computer systems were paralysed tomorrow by some unbelievable hack, we'd go back to the 60s. What's wrong with that? Well, I'm being a bit facetious, but, you know, we had cars in the 60s, we had TV sets in the 60s, we had refrigerators in the 60s, yes, dishwashers, you know, it was a pretty comfortable time. Okay, we didn't have, you know, everything we have today in terms of information. Things were a bit more primitive, but it's not the Stone Age. So we have to keep a sense of proportion. And also societies are incredibly resilient, ladies and gentlemen, to efforts to disrupt them. I mean, I mentioned the bombing campaigns of World War II, where you know, the sense that people would panic, would desert, you know, would never go back to work, those fears proved totally, at the end of the day, overplayed. The brave citizens of Sarajevo withstood a siege from 1992 to 1995. We are more resilient, frankly, when confronted with these type of problems than we think we are. But that said, no complacency, because we don't know how this is going to evolve over the next few years. And the potential of cyber attacks is major. I read, for example, an article in Foreign Affairs recently by Wes Clark, the former Supreme Allied Commander, which claims, and I do not know if this is true or not, but it claims that when the Israeli Air Force attacked the Syrian reactor, you recall, which was covered by secrecy, and the details only came out later, the article claims that the Syrian air defence did not operate against the Israeli Air Force because of a bug which was activated inside the computers of the air defence system, which could then be put out of action before the that took place. If that kind of level of sophistication is possible, then it's clear that as long as our military systems, we see this, you know, with network-centric warfare, the revolution of military affairs require increasingly on digitised weaponry, digitised communications, and so on, that we could be vulnerable. Not necessarily to a defeat, as I've said, the effect is likely to be temporary, but at least a major setback. And I do not want to eliminate the possibility of massive loss of life flowing from this. So far, all of the research I've done, and I don't claim to be the world's expert on this, but all of the research I've done only came up with one example where an American generator was put out of action in a minor explosion by a cyber attack. We've had examples of disgruntled people in Los Angeles putting the traffic light system out of action, which could cause car accidents and deaths, that's true. But as I say, so far it's mainly the systems fail rather than people die. But there is no room for complacency as this goes on. So no panic, but no complacency either. This is like nuclear weapons, something that we will just simply have to learn to live with in our lives as we go forward. That said, as I come now to the end, looking at the six challenges, what would therefore I recommend, if I were able to recommend, to the people developing NATO's new strategic concept about the challenges? Well, clearly, the first conclusion would be we have to keep an eye on all of them. The art of strategy is not cutting up your resources sixfold. It's like 1/6 for this, 1/6 for that, because that often means that you won't develop any progress on any of them through too modest an investment. But the other strategy is to keep an eye on things, so that even though you're dealing with priorities, you nonetheless are tracking what's going on in other areas. And if these other areas suddenly develop into a massive existential threat, you don't start from scratch. You have the policies, you have the knowledge, you have the technologies to deal with them. But that said, looking at all of the challenges, I would nominate two to be at the top of the priority. The first one is proliferation. Why? Because, as I said, so far, thank God, cyber attacks have not led to massive loss of life. And the primary function of an alliance like NATO is to protect the lives of its populations and as far as possible, the lives of other people. At the end of the day, dying from a bullet is much worse than having your bank account shut down for 2 days in a cyber attack. You can survive that and you can recover. And today, whether you like it or not, the one thing that can kill millions of people is a nuclear exchange. And I said in a previous lecture that proliferation is now a reality. Not that that worst case scenario is going to happen, but we can't say that it's excluded either. And so to my mind, preventing that proliferation nightmare through arms control, through missile defences and so on, it should be at the top of NATO's priority. Secondly, ladies and gentlemen, failed states. The subject of my lecture last time. Why do I nominate this? Well, because it's going to be such a universal problem. I came up with 60 failed or failing states last week, and because, as I said last time, we've seen how those failing states can not only be a miserable experience for their own populations in terms of women's rights, human rights abuses, the death of innocent civilians, the exploitation of natural resources by criminal networks, the syndrome of Michela Wrong. It's our turn to eat. It's our turn to eat, to name her recent book. In other words, that one ethnic group takes power and takes revenge in terms of monopolising the resources, giving them only to its ethnic group because it feels that it's its turn to eat. It's been excluded from power for too long. But it's not these failed states are not only a menace to their own populations, but in terms of playing host to criminal networks, terrorist networks, illicit drug production and so on, we've increasingly seen that they contaminate our security before too long as well. So if for both strategic reasons but also humanitarian reasons, I put failed states, proliferation at the top of my list. But as I've said, you never know. Everybody who predicts the future gets it wrong. I will be no different from anybody else in that respect, and we should keep a close eye on these other challenges in the hope that they do not reach the priority level of the first two, but knowing that that could still yet happen to us. Thank you very much.
I don't know if it's relevant for you here, but why would they hack your health system?
Well, in a sense, it's to basically steal secrets and information which have some kind of commercial value for resale.
Commercial value
for resale, yes. Which can, for example, you can use confidential information on patients, for instance, which this can be sold to pharmaceutical companies, for instance, as well results of lab tests, results of drug tests, and so on. That's one thing. There is a lot of organised criminal networks around that share this information to each other. That said, it's true that the financial institutions are the ones that report suffering the greatest number of attacks, because the dream of every criminal is to be able to transfer money from a legal account into an illegal account. But the statistics do show up that health features are very strongly indeed.
Thank you. Seeing the vulnerability of cyberspace, how do you see e-governance progressing in the future?
Well, I think the with now, of course, with all of these security issues, we're in a situation where there are two basic approaches, and this comes out in climate change too when you talk about governance. The first one is the idea of universal regimes, like, for example, post-Kyoto universal climate change agreement. But if that's not achievable, or if it would be meaningless because it would be the lowest common denominator, then the second approach is the sort of regional agreements. You see this in trade as well. If you can't have a global WTO trade agreement, a Doha round,
you go for regional agreements, you know, and one has been recently launched in Asia, a free trade regime. And you hope that more and more people join those regional agreements and gradually they spread and in time they set the universal standard. And I think in cyber what we're going to see, for example, in organisations like NATO that bring together like-minded states, is increasingly the attempt to sort of forge sort of internal arrangements which protect the interests of the organisation. And in the case of an organisation like NATO, because you can add on all of your partners, then it becomes more universal. For example, I mentioned last week that we have in Afghanistan 15 non-NATO countries participating in operations. Well, those countries, Sweden, Finland, have to have the same cyber protection for their intelligence, for their command or communication arrangements as allies. And in fact, we can't afford theirs to be compromised, because if theirs are compromised, everything is locked together, ours would be compromised. So my sense is that we will go for the sector-by-sector type of arrangements. Private companies will come together to exchange best practice, for example, to establish an effective early warning system as well. One of the problems is that there are so many areas of vulnerability. For example, the software, obviously, the hardware. Manufacturers could put into the system before they deliver it to you a virus that you don't know about. It happens. For example, my country, the UK, after the Second World War, we gave the German Enigma code machine away to a number of countries with bugs in. Very good, huh? So that you never know that the hardware hasn't been compromised before you even buy. And one of the issues, by the way, of computer hardware is that more and more of it is imported. You know, the United States, 20 years ago, IBM made its own computer hardware. Now it buys components from India, from China, from Indonesia, from everywhere. How do you know they haven't been compromised? Then is the seams between the hardware and the software, the communications channel, the configuration of the system, the behaviour of users and operators, and, of course, as I said, the ISPs, the Internet Service Providers. So there is a number of ways in which hackers can get into your system. And, of course, that means to say that as people are more and more joined up, of course, like in alliances acting together, you know, individual country protection is less and less valued, frankly, than it was in the past. There's no Maginot line. And therefore, you're going to have to sort of try to have universal systems of the people that you deal with, so it can't be compromised. And the other, let me just add something here. When I first joined NATO, I won't say when, because you'd be even more horrified than me, but basically the software, we developed our own software, for example, for air defence systems. Now everybody's stopped that these days. Everybody uses the commercial stuff, you know, the Microsoft, the Windows and so on, those applications, which are universal, and tries to build security into those universal applications. You know, people have sort of stopped trying to sort of develop their own sort of internal systems, which nobody else can access. And therefore, as I say, I think the idea of at least trying to draw together, you know, your sort of wider community of people you deal with and forge a system there in the hope that that best practice will then catch on is probably the way it's going to go. A universal agreement, if it's toothless, and that's probably what's likely, would not fix the problem. Yes, sir.
D'Acosta from the Council of the European Union. I have a question concerning internet bots, armies that are up for hire in the internet. There have been recently some activities from security experts that got together and dissected a bit about the behavior of these bot armies and proceeding in dismantling, in fact, to make it harmless and ending it. What's your view on that, about taking a bit the law in your own hands?
Well, this is true. This is why there is so much ambiguity in this area. For example, you need to sort of probe other people's systems so that you know whether your own system is vulnerable in many respects. So to some degree, some so-called attack systems could be defence.
In the sense that you think you're being attacked, because, or you think somebody is attacking you because you see activity, illicit activity, and so you probe others to try to sort of find out who's attacking you, and then that person thinks he's being attacked. Do you understand? So everybody, you know, it's like the origin of the First World War. Everybody thought that they were defending themselves when they mobilised, and yet everybody else thought that they were being attacked. And the difference between defensive measures and aggressive measures, if you like, became incredibly blurred, so that everybody thinks that they are the victim and the other person is aggressor. So I agree with you. I think this is a particularly difficult area where you have more and more people in military establishments or states that can devote, you know, quite considerable resources to these kind of activities, spending their days, you know, trying to gather information, but more importantly, trying to probe the other's system, not only to seek out the vulnerabilities in that the other person's system, but in their own system as well. And this leads then to this kind of action-reaction sort of chain of events. I think that the only way we're going to get basically around that, ultimately, when you mention, you know, the sort of the bot elements, is that we're going to sort of have to have a sort of a clear sort of distinction between that which is kind of, you know, the normal practice, you know, where states are spying on each other all the time, and, you know, they make protests and people are expelled and then everything goes back to normal. That kind of level, which I think is a reality that we're going to have to live with. I don't see any way around that. You know, you're not going to tell countries to stop, you know, gathering information on each other, but a clear distinction as to, you know, that type of level, and a level which is then of a more malicious type, which is, you know, either sort of paralysing activities or getting information that could paralyse activities or hacking into core systems and so on. I mean, you could, for example, try to have some kind of arms control regime to stop this happening. For example, you know, in classical arms control, you have an agreement not to use space for weapons. To put the competition into certain areas. So we have an agreement since 1967 not to put weapons in space, or an agreement not to put weapons on the seabed. Or we are trying now to think of an agreement not to have anti-satellite capabilities. Just like a few years ago, the United States had an agreement with each other not to have a missile defence systems. Remember the ABM treaty? Or just one system and then no systems. So I think the question, the only way around that, as I see, would be if you can have, maybe not universally, but between states that have the most major capabilities, Russia, China, obviously the United States and some others, sort of bilateral sort of arms control agreements, which is that, okay, you know, we'll do this, but certain areas, maybe air defense, maybe, you know, satellite systems, GPS navigation systems would sort of, you know, be off limits, and that therefore then you would all have sort of diplomatic instruments were those off-limit systems are going to be attacked. I think that this sort of code of conduct, which would be negotiated between states, would be the best approach. Let me just add to that in this respect, that the United States and Russia have been trying for some years to negotiate a cyber agreement between the two. The difference being that the Russians want to focus mainly on the military systems, and the United States wants to deal more with private sector sort of, you know, criminal activities as well. But they are trying, and I think it'd be really fascinating if you have this sort of first sort of cyber arms control agreement, you know, which could be a model for others.
You mentioned the banks, you mentioned the health structures, and the issues with software and hardware reliability, which makes me want to hear a little bit more from you in terms of cyber attacks being a huge threat in terms of massive disruption to critical infrastructures. We're talking networks of electricity, water supplies, of energy. Normally would be the key, energy supply would be the key, but there are other critical infrastructures that could be at risk.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we're going to have to design these systems increasingly with vulnerabilities and attack in mind. The one thing, and this also responds to a previous question that may help, is that as more and more countries come to depend upon the internet for their vital services, they all may have an interest in keeping
the internet open, because it was not designed for secrecy, you remember. In other words, the value to them economically, you know, the Chinese financial systems, or, you know, the Russian dependence on pipeline flows, may be such that the value to them of keeping the system open is greater than the value of disrupting somebody else's. In other words, you know, why hurt somebody else if the hurt to you is going to be greater? It doesn't make sense. That is maybe the one saving grace in cyber. We still have a problem, of course, of people using it to extract information. But the idea of cyber attacks for disruption will go down simply because, what we don't have at the moment, which is what I mentioned, this idea of deterrence based on proportionality. My system is as valuable to me as your system is as valuable to you, and therefore I won't attack you. We don't have that, but if we could have that, it could be different. That's a more sort of philosophical point to make. But let me just illustrate what I mean. Now, there has not been a great deal of evidence so far of terrorists or Al-Qaeda launching sort of cyber attacks, obviously information and so on. The reason is they rely, as I said in my terrorism lecture, overwhelmingly today, not on training camps in Afghanistan and Pakistan, but on cyber recruiting. You know, the websites where they preach the Salafist form of Islam, where they show the videos, you know, where they give the techniques and so on. And therefore, if suddenly they were denied that use of the internet, their value as a terrorist organisation would decline very, very, very dramatically. So again, it's a rather perverse example where a group has got more of an interest in having the current open system continue, which they believe is working in their favour as a recruitment tool, than getting into a sort of, you know, a kind of system of terrorism. Cyber attacks against us, knowing that at the end of the day that they would lose and they would suffer more. So that maybe is a ray of hope. But in the meantime, you're right. I mean, we have to design systems with, for example, air brakes, obviously, between various systems. We have to have backup systems, you know, just like in Lebanon a few years ago, every house had a generator. For when the electricity was switched off, they then brought out the generator and off they went. We'll have to have backup systems. And my own sense, frankly, is that we also will need a kind of the old-fashioned manual system to be kept in use if the high-tech computerized system is put out of action. Frankly, for extreme sort of circumstances, so that, you know, essential sort of functions can continue to work. That said, also, early warning is important. Cyber attacks, are basically announced in advance. You know, you see a higher degree of activity before the critical mass is achieved. And I think the intelligence function of being able to very quickly realise that something abnormal is happening, to pinpoint which vulnerability it's going to, and then be able to shut down that particular thing. What I've learned, at least not being a technical person, but simply from research, is that what happens with a cyber attack is that somebody, it's like a peephole. You know, it's like that, you know, I don't sort of see into your bedroom in the evening because your curtains are closed, but I'm peeping through the little gap in your curtain and trying to see what I can find inside. So the attack creates a kind of breach, but does not immediately allow, you know, the virus to sort of spread the entirety of the your system. So to the extent that you know we're able to detect the initial breach, you can sort of, like a ship, you know, which a ship is designed, should be, I don't think this was the case with the Titanic, but a ship is designed to have certain sort of watertight compartments, as you know. So that if, you know, you hit an iceberg a la Titanic, you know, the water comes in, but you shut down that compartment with firewalls so that the water doesn't spread and you can continue with a ship, just like an aircraft. You know, you shut down the engine, which is caught on fire, as fire. So I think we're going to have to sort of build systems in future with the idea that, you know, the contaminated areas can be immediately shut down with firewalls before, you know, the viruses replicate themselves, obviously, and spread elsewhere. Anyway, again, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for being with me. You can't have lectures if you don't have an audience, so again, I appreciate that, and I wish you all the best, and hope to see you again sometime in the future, when there are more security challenges to discuss, obviously. Thank you.